Speaker Jiryu Mark Lichtenbeiler, who is a good friend of mine from many years back, and we practiced together at Tassajara and Green Gulch. Jiryu came to San Francisco Zen Center in 1996, and along the way got ordained as a priest, and also practiced in Japan for about a year and a half, partly at the same monastery where I practice in Japan, so we have that connection too, and has recently put together a book of his excerpts from practicing in America and Japan called Two Shores of Zen. And so, some interesting blog, interactive web places to explore issues of Japanese and American Zen, and a site called No Zen in the West, kind of controversial, intentionally, title. And so, Jiryu also have books, this book, Two Shores of Zen, will be available at tea time afterwards if you like. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. This is Kokyo, of course, who you all are taking good care of. We miss him at Green Gulch and are happy that you adopted him. But we do miss him. It's nice to be in this Zendo. I know a few of you here, and I know the room a little bit, having washed up here for a couple weeks, 10 or 12 years back, on a sort of doomed attempt to escape from Tassajara, in Rosie's car, actually.
That's right, I forgot.
Yeah, I stayed at, in a room that Rosie had for a while, and did brokenhearted practice for a while here in Santa Cruz, imagining some other life than the one that I was having. And really took refuge in this sangha, and the warm feeling here. Part of what happened when I left Tassajara, whenever that was in '99 or something, in the middle of a practice period, which you're not supposed to do, snuck out for a day, which you're also not supposed to do, and then I wanted to get back in because I was just going to sneak out for a day. And then there was a big snowstorm, so I couldn't get back in. So I was stuck. Eventually I made it back in, but it didn't last long because the momentum, or my need to be at Tassajara, was already broken. And there was too much that I needed to take care of, particularly this relationship that I was trying to sustain that didn't really support the monastic life. I needed to be willing to enter the world in a different way than just monastic forms. And so to leave the temple and to come do everyday life practice, and then to find that in the middle of that, here was this oasis, the Santa Cruz Zen Center, where people were upholding the forms, and this surprisingly formal practice, actually, in service of everyday, ordinary life practice. And that's some of what I want to talk about tonight. Something that's been on my mind a lot lately is how much form do we need? How much formal practice, how much monastic practice, you could say, or even deliberate practice, how much Zen do we need in our life? And how much do we need to just accept our life completely as it is and let the life that we have, whatever we're doing, be our Zen? You know? So for a while, I was pretty clear that Zen practice was not about accepting the life that you had, but but was about acquiring the most Zen life you could possibly acquire. So at kind of the climax of that, I went to Japan, and my story of that sort of summarized here on the back of this book that really only brought because Awa mentioned that there might be some interest here. The way I summarize the book also kind of summarizes my own path, in a sense, through sort of acquiring Zen and then letting go a little bit of this kind of monastic, this need to do the ultimate monastic practice. So I say here, when a young American Buddhist monk can no longer bear the pop psychology, sexual intrigue, and free-flowing peanut butter that he insists pollute his spiritual community, you have a sense of where mind was 10 or 12 years ago. Not so pleasant to be around. He sets out for Japan on an archetypal journey to find true Zen, a magical elixir to relieve all suffering. Arriving at an austere Japanese monastery and meeting a fierce old Zen master, he feels confirmed in his suspicion that the Western Buddhist approach is a spineless imitation of authentic spiritual effort. However, kind of predictable arc here. It didn't work. To run far away to find your real life is maybe something we all need to go through. But what you find at the end is that it's still your life. And that maybe next time you can try to run a little slower or run a little less and maybe eventually completely stop running, completely be the life that we actually have. But we can't do that without support. So how much support do we need to really just find our place in our life? Over the course of a year and a half of bitter initiations, relentless meditation and labor, intense cold, brutal discipline, insanity, overwhelming lust, and false breakthroughs, he grows disenchanted with the Asian model as well. Surprise? If you tend to be disenchanted, chances are you'll be disenchanted wherever you go. You bring it with you. That everyone else is wrong kind of goes with you wherever you go. Finally completing the classic journey of the seeker who travels far to discover the home he has left, he returns, this is a little optimistic, but he returns to the U.S. with a more mature appreciation of Western Buddhism and a new confidence in his life as it is. So you can see that I had this strong image that Zen meant to do this kind of strict, hard training. And in part, that came out of my experience actually doing strict, hard training and feeling like, wow, there are really some fruits of this practice. So there must be bigger fruits of doing it more. So when I either imagined or, you know, heard about or received images from this kind of strict training, I got this idea that there's not really Zen practice here in the West. Even what we were doing at Tassajara seemed really sloppy compared to this kind of idea of what true monasticism is. And then I would occasionally meet people, you know, who would kind of pull me aside and say, yeah, kid, you know, there's not really any Zen here. These people, they're nice people, you know. Don't get me wrong, they're good people, but this isn't Zen. And it played right into my idea. That, Yeah, that we were basically weren't providing the conditions that were Zen practice. It seemed like Zen in the West, you know, American Buddhist practice was just accommodating people wherever they were at, you know, not really challenging our views or forcing us to kind of break out of patterns or lifestyles, but really claiming that you could find the Zen practice within within a kind of worldly lifestyle, which seemed at odds with some of these books, you know, that talk about the kind of bone-crushing spiritual effort, you know, that is a so-called authentic practice. And then there were other people who would say, you know, well, okay, I hear you're going to go to Japan, but you know, there's not really any Zen in Japan. Zen is like totally dead there. They just do a lot of ceremonies. And even if you go to a place where they do a lot of Zazen, then all they do is a lot of Zazen. And what's that? You know, that's just stuck in Zazen, stuck in formal practice without the flexibility to find practice everywhere. So, everybody has their view about what Zen practice is and who has it and who doesn't. I was thinking about this story lately of Layman Pong, famous Zen, awakened Zen layperson, and his awakened lay family. So I looked up this story. It seemed to express part of what I'm trying to talk around here tonight and what's been on my mind a lot lately. So the story is, the layman was sitting in his thatched cottage one day, presumably studying the sutras. Difficult, difficult, he said. Like trying to scatter 10 measures of sesame seed all over a tree. And then his wife, Mrs. Peng, said, "Easy, easy, like touching your feet to the ground when you get out of bed." And then his daughter, Acharya Ling Zhao, said, "Neither difficult nor easy. On the 100 grass tips, the great master's meaning." So I had this feeling like this is really, when we talk about Zen and the, you know, Japanese Zen, Eastern, you know, Asian Buddhism and American Western Buddhism. Part of what we're asking, or part of what's at play, is this question of, is the way difficult or is the way easy? You know? Is it something, does it demand that we change our life, or does it completely allow us to have the life that we have? And in revisiting that koan and in thinking about these questions, I feel like really to say either way, to think that we know what Zen is and that it is difficult, or that we know what Zen is and it is easy, seems like we're missing half, you know. If I say that Zen is only when you're like, you know, sleeping 2 hours and eating thin rice and sitting all the time, then I'm sort of opening the whole other side of that. I'm saying that there's no Zen can't, you know, our practice can't really penetrate all of the easy practice. And then when we say, well, Zen practice is completely easy in the sense of it doesn't touch conditions at all, it doesn't alter, we don't need to make any special effort, then we're kind of excluding the practice that is sort of intense, deliberate effort. So where I'm left more than this question, much more than this question of East or West, is what do we need, how much support do we need in our life and practice to make this sort of wide open, all-inclusive core of Zen become really felt, become a really palpable, lived experience. You know, I can say that every moment of our life is a complete opportunity for Zen practice. There's no moment, no matter where we go, or who we study with, or how hard they hit us, or how nice they are to us, there's no moment that has more, say, awakening potential than any other moment. Fundamentally, there's no moment that supports our practice or that enables our practice any more than any other moment. So whether we're on the bus or whether we're in the meditation hall or whether we're in an argument, or cooking dinner, or washing the dishes, we are completely, the way is completely accessible and available. And I really believe that, but I'm not, but I know too that my access to that depends on some kind of support, some kind of condition. So I've been, as I talk to people at Green Gulch, I sometimes have this feeling like we hear and we kind of learn this language of, yes, Zen is everywhere. Zen is everywhere. And we get used to talking in that way and thinking that. And that can sometimes, that idea can sometimes even undermine somebody's practice. You know, somebody who has the opportunity to focus their mind more deliberately or to engage in some kind of supportive retreat or something, picks up this idea that they read or heard but haven't quite penetrated, this idea that, well, Zen is, you know, you don't really need to meditate because Zen is completely accessible everywhere, and then proceed not to meditate, which feels like, oh, something is lost there about what our practice is or can be. But on the other hand, if all we know about Zen practice is making this conscious, deliberate effort, then we're not really opening to the full possibility of finding our way exactly wherever we are. So I've been studying this question or thinking about this in terms of our life and the conditions of our life. You know, how often do we need to come to Zen Center? And then when we do come to Zen Center, are we coming to Zen Center in order to sort of get some practice that we can keep? Or are we coming to Zen Center in order to strengthen our resolve to meet each moment outside of Zen Center as practice? How much form and how much emptiness, or how much effort and how much letting go? So we say, don't change anything about your life. This is the best thing and the worst thing about California Zen. You don't have to change anything about your life. Just let go, surrender to your life completely. Whatever condition is arising, completely surrender to it and become it. And don't hold out for any other kind of spiritual opportunity beyond the exact conditions of your life. So how much accepting do we do in our practice? And then how much changing? How much sort of standing up and saying, this needs to change about my life. I need to sit every day because this isn't working. Or, you know, I gave this talk recently at Green Gulch where I really just emphasized this aspect of our practice of having no illusions that what we're doing in Zen is anywhere other than this exact moment. So don't think about next time you get to go to Zen Center. And don't imagine any opportunity for practice other than the moment right in front of you. And don't change your life. Don't touch your life. Leave your life exactly as it is. Completely being the life that you have is completely fulfilling Zen. And as soon as there's some idea that, oh, I need to get away from my life, I need to change my life so there's more Zen, then we've lost what Zen practices. So I spoke to this, which is a very important point for me, in terms of accepting my own life and getting over my own idea that maybe someday I'm going to have a Zen enough life, and actually just dealing with the life, being willing to be the life I have. And, you know, going to San Quentin State Prison helps, where we do meditation instruction and and have a Buddhist group. It's not so different from this one or any other Zen group. And we say, sure, you're in jail, you know, sure, you've been in for 25 years and you're not going to get out, and every moment of your day is completely sort of inflexible and given to you, and you have no freedom over your conditions. But that doesn't matter to real liberation. Real liberation is just completely being willing to be this limitation that you have. It's very inspiring to go and to feel the power of that teaching, that if Zen meant you had to change your life, then it'd be no good to go to San Quentin and tell them, well, you could do Zen, but you need to like change your life in these five ways, because they can't. They don't have the power to change their life. And actually, none of us have the power to change our life. But we can accept our life, and by completely accepting our limitation and our struggles, then we can find a kind of freedom. So I gave this talk, and then afterwards I felt like this is what is called the opiate of the masses. Don't change anything, you know? If you've got a crappy job, just work the crappy job and surrender to the job, you know? If you have dysfunctional relationships, just completely be willing to be dysfunctionally relating, you know? And it's not untrue, but it happens also to be the opiate of the masses. And it happens to be actually the point that Soto Zen and American Zen, maybe more broadly, but Soto Zen in particular, is really strongly criticized about. It's like, well, if you're just raising this side, you're missing this whole other part about standing up in our life and standing up in our practice and, you know, speaking and shouting our truth, actually, and being willing to go against the flow, you know. Sometimes Buddhist practice is described as going against the current. So how much flowing with the current and how much taking a stand in our life? So this applies to this kind of broader question of how much do I come to Zen Center. And also I find very importantly in each period of meditation, in Zazen, how much are we sort of doing this kind of caricature of California practice, you know, accepting everything practice, shikantaza, you know, just sit there, surrender to your life. And how much are we doing kind of directed, effortful, you know, concentration practice or deliberate meditation practice? Somebody actually in Japan who was more of the concentration school said, shikantaza. You know, these people think that you can just sit down and do shikantaza. You know, maybe Dogen did shikantaza once, you know. maybe the Buddha, you know, under the Bodhi tree did genuine shikantaza. But mostly when you just say accept everything completely, just sit there, don't do anything, just be your life. If there's no support for that, if there's nothing you can do, it's hard to make it meaningful, or it's hard to really feel it. So this is the ultimate truth. This is really the key and the core of Zen practice, is just not doing anything and letting go completely. But how do we realize that? You know, we do meditation instruction. If people come in from the street and want to know about Zen practice, sometimes we say, well, just sit there. And that's kind of great. It's and it's sort of like, well, could you help a little? You know, can I have something to help me with that actually really difficult thing of like completely opening to my life? I need a little help. It's too hard to just sit there and do that. So this kind of compassionately offering some tool like a meditation hall or like concentration on the breath. But every time we offer it and every time we practice it, remembering that the reason we're offering it and the reason we're practicing it isn't for its own sake, but to enable this wide open, complete letting go practice. So we don't make a Zen center so that people will come to the Zen center and do the Zen thing. We make a Zen center to support people to find this kind of letting go in the life that they have when they're not at Zen center. And when we focus on our breathing, or follow our breathing, or concentrate on our belly center, or whatever it is that we use to support and energize our sitting practice, we're not doing that for its own sake. We're not doing that to get really concentrated on the breath or to get really strong in the hara. We're doing that to create some energy that will support this complete letting go. So I'm feeling like, you know, whether it's east and west or effort and non-effort, this kind of back and forth, this tension, this dynamic, isn't something to just take a stand on and decide, you know, what position we have. It's actually the engine of practice. It's the dynamic kind of turning of the Dharma wheel, actually. So that's some of what's been on my mind, and I wonder how you all find that. We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if you've studied in your own life how much you need, and then how much is actually too much. It's like, well, actually now I'm breathing in my meditation like I'm really trying to get something out of my meditation, or I'm going to Zen center kind of like I have to, you know, rather than this wide open support. So how much is too much and how much is too little? How do we hold the tools just as tools, but still picking up the tools? So I wonder if anyone has any thoughts on that or any feeling about that in their own practice that they wanted to share.
Well, you know, I think for me the kind of inquiring and questioning that you have just offered, and that we do that together as a sangha. To me, that is very supporting. That we come here, not, you know, supported by the place, yes, supported by the teaching that you just are offering, thank you. But that, you know, we come here together. To me, that and that inquiring spirit, and for me, just asking, like, well, you know, sometimes I don't know what I'm doing here. Why I came exactly. But there's this sense of being drawn, and then other times, so that weaving that has to do with wondering, not knowing.
And what I'm hearing too in that is the kind of diversity of Sangha, where if you're in a kind of letting go phase, there's going to be someone else who's in a working hard phase, you know, to help you, to remind you that there's some work to do. And the opposite, you know, if you're trying to get somewhere in your practice, probably someone else in the Sangha is at a place of real letting go. So that's part of this no Zen in the West thing. I'm trying to keep those voices close, you know, to include that part of the Sangha, you know, so that with all the different voices, we can actually maybe achieve some kind of balance. You know, maybe the middle way is all of us being extreme in some kind of balanced way.
Wonderful talk. I mean, we have been talking about this subject a lot in our own way recently. I mean, you know, just that whole thing of acceptance on one end and change on the other, and, you know, equanimity and being okay with everything and action on the other. And I think what I'm most appreciating in what you're saying, a couple things. One is that the actual engaging with the tension of this seeming opposition is itself the engine of practice, mm-hmm. and turning the Dharma wheel. I'd say that's kind of what I've settled on now after all these decades of pretty much just beating myself up that I'm not a good enough, you know, Zen practitioner. And, you know, kind of going from one extreme to the other, you know, exploring the extreme of being really good and coming all the time and the extreme of never coming, you know, and realizing that neither of those is truly, you know, who I am. And I don't know, actually, who I am here. But I know that to show up is, you know, key. And because it is a community practice, our school is a community practice. You know, and even though it looks so solitary, we do it in community, and Buddha practiced in community. I think if we look at Buddha's life, we also see that, you know, he didn't just stay under the Bodhi tree. I think sometimes this point is missed. He took lots of action. First of all, he sat down, then he got up, and then he responded to the request to teach and engaged with his sangha, including his, you know, the women who were pulling at his sleeve and saying, excuse me, you know, and he changed his mind on that. I mean, I see this model of a real engaged, thinking, you know, person, not just this, oh, be with it, whatever it is. So even the model of the founder, I see he is engaged in this dynamic process.
I love that expression you used, settling on the turning, you know. I'm settling in the dynamic, settling on the motion. None of those still places were very settled. Those still places were very agitated. But in the motion, I can find some stability. Appreciate that phrase, settled in the turning. In the back, is it Patrick?
The question that comes up in a place like Santa Cruz, of course, is real Zen here, or is real Zen at Tosahara and Green Gulch? You know, both of which are relatively right in our backyards, but very different practice. And so, I mean, for me, that question of effort comes up, and sometimes I'm very happy with just the effort of going from wandering thoughts back to the breath. And at other times, you know, I just have to change everything, and maybe sitting helps, and or maybe something, you know, maybe another practice helps, or another form of action. So I'm kind of in Kathy's camp where, just trying to keep close to that tension point. What works for me? Thank you for coming down.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. Liz, you have
great topic and talk, and I know it's questions that grapple with all the time, and so it's very refreshing to have it discussed. And I think maybe I have a lot of personal discomfort with my kind of, I guess, wherever I am. So that's and now that I'm not in the monastery, I often kind of think I'm not participating in the formal practice enough, but the aliveness is in just continuing to work with all these questions. Definitely the formal practice, the sitting and the coming and being with the Sangha and the ceremonies really completely supports the my vow to be present in my other life. And when I there was a way in which living at Green Gulch and at Tassajara, I felt like I was kind of hiding from something or not really fully living my life. So yeah, it's a very, very live topic. The last couple of nights, I was just being with a young family that I live with, and they're maybe going to the emergency room and maybe going again in the middle of the night, and so not coming here in the morning, and it good letting go to just kind of say, well, this is the most important thing, being with the people that I'm with and being a loving support.
Yeah, as opposed to, sorry, I don't have time to support you in the emergency right now. I have to go learn how to let go of everything and meet conditions as they arise. Yeah. You also had a, did you also want to offer something?
Some has been said, but I really like the image of the current, of like going with the current and sometimes going against the current. I resonate with that because sometimes I feel like I'm too much of a California flow boy, and then other times I'm kind of like a staunch iconoclast. And those are the extremes, of course, but I'm aware of that a lot recently. I think I've been just kind of going with the flow and allow myself to be almost victimized by kind of forces in my life, other commitments that I have, and then really missing the kind of uprightness that I've had and consistency with practice that is very well supported by Sangha, you know, and sometimes I need it more than others. Sometimes I have it in my more solitary practice just fine, and the motivation and inspiration and everything's there. But right now, you know, times like now, I feel like in my life, it's like it's really, probably really good for me to be around a Sangha and be a little bit close. Sometimes, you know, it's like the whole thing where it's like you're too close to the teacher, you get burned, you're too far away, you don't get enough heat. It's kind of, it feels like that. I've, you know, tried to live in Dharma centers, and at times it's been appropriate, at times it's been not so appropriate. You know, I needed more freedom to really take care of my life. And then other times, you know, but also it was really good for practice and it really helped serve showing up in my life. So it's you mentioned like a heartbroken kind of practice at some point. Like right now it feels like it's heartbreaking. It's kind of a heartbreaking topic to me. Okay.
Thank you. That sometimes letting go sometimes looks like going with the flow and sometimes looks like not. That's that's part of what comes up for me in hearing you. We think letting go would look like something, but actually letting go is just letting go into whatever natural activity, which sometimes is going with and sometimes is going against, as opposed to, no, I should let go, so forget it. Anyway. Thank you. I think there's time for one more comment. Sally?
I've heard often here, if you really want to deepen your practice, come and do sesshin. And, you know, I have done sesshin and I have experienced that, but often I don't have time to come and do sesshin. And so when you say that every moment there's the opportunity, enlightenment or if I'm home and I'm paying my bills and all I'm doing is paying my bills, or if I'm picking up toys, I'm just picking up toys, am I really getting that same sort of depth?
Well, when you're sitting sesshin, sometimes you're there and sometimes you're not there. That's kind of what a sesshin is many hours of being there and being not there, you know. And then when you're picking up toys and paying bills, sometimes you're there and sometimes you're not there. There's something about sesshin and the Sangha treasure, you know, where there's people reminding you, you know, kind of poking and asking, like, are you there? So it's helpful, but this is part of what I found in going to Japan. It's like, okay, this form is, I guess it's helpful, but it's not doing the work for me. I can either, I have a moment right now, and I can, wherever I am, I have a moment, and I can arrive, or I can not arrive, you know? And that choice to arrive or not arrive in each moment is exactly the same whether it's sesshin or not sesshin. I think a lot of time is wasted in sesshin, and a lot of awakening is happening over household chores. So I find when I think I should be in sesshin, or I should like to be in sesshin, or I'd like to sit, or I wish I could practice, that for me, I think we can train our mind so that that's a cue to actually practice. It's like, oh, I want to do a sesshin? Okay. Sesshin begins now. bring that mind, you know, because then even if I figure it out, you know, and like quit my job and go do so I can do the sesshin, I still have to make that choice to arrive or not arrive. The sesshin, the form, doesn't do it for me, and that's what I hoped, you know. I hoped I could go to Japan and it would do it for me, and it didn't. It was me. It was the same mind, and I say that to myself over and over, you know, even at Tosahara, I remember trying to really train that into my mind. Like, when you leave here, I think you're going to be nostalgic about Tosahara. I was kind of sending myself a message to the future. But don't be, because this is just, you're just going to be exactly the same person wherever you are. So in sesshin or out of sesshin, in the forms or out of the forms, are we completely taking up the opportunity without kind of copping out and thinking that we need the forms to take the opportunity? Thank you. Thank you, though, for your question. Because yeah, then the other side is, we don't know what to say. When someone wants to deepen their practice, it's like, oh, I don't know, why don't you do a sesshin? You know, it's like, oh, was that helpful? I don't know. But it's kind of all we got. It's all we've got. But don't be stuck there. It's all we've got, and it's a big trap, you know? Just like the Zen Center, it's a big trap. And it's a big help. So thank you for the invitation and the warm greeting here, and the wonderful Sangha everywhere, appreciation for Sangha. So please continue to take care of each other, and in so doing, may the merit extend endlessly throughout space and time, bringing benefit and real liberation to all beings.